President Obama talked about it when he accepted his party's nomination for a second time.
Climate change is not a hoax. More droughts and floods and wildfires are not a joke. They are a threat to our children's future. And in this election, you can do something about it.
He was asked about it at his first news conference after his November win.
I am a firm believer that climate change is real, that it is impacted by human behavior and carbon emissions. And as a consequence, I think we've got an obligation to future generations to do something about it.
And he highlighted it in his second inaugural address.
We will respond to the threat of climate change, knowing that the failure to do so would betray our children and future generations.
President Obama has been talking the talk recently when it comes to climate change. But with a stagnant economy and a divided Congress, what, if anything, can he actually do about it? Joining us is Washington Post environmental reporter Juliet Elprin. Juliet, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thanks so much.
And Juliet, the president didn't talk much about climate change during his first term. But as we just heard, he seems to be getting more vocal about it now and more often. And you've written that in his inaugural address, he framed climate change more as a moral issue than as an economic or a national security one. What do you think has changed in his thinking or in the general landscape to trigger that?
I think part of it is frankly that he's really just speaking out about how he has most likely viewed this issue for quite a while, but didn't feel comfortable talking about in the run-up to his reelection. So there's no question he's made passing remarks, both in private and in public, about the idea that he considers this very important and that he does consider this a generational issue, that he looks ahead, he looks to his daughter's generation and beyond, and he does think that you're going to have severe impacts associated with climate change. So it's something that has mattered to him, certainly intellectually, for quite a while. But there's no question that given some of the economic and political challenges of the first term, it's not something that he engaged on in this moral way until this moment.
And because he doesn't have to run again, and in many ways, it's safer to sort of really take it on now.
Absolutely. He can he has the liberty to do this. Again, as we can discuss, there are, you know, certain options that are open to him and there are certain ones that aren't. But I get the sense from talking to people who have spoken to him, particularly in recent months, that he feels like he needs to be more outspoken about this, in part because, again, it has been downplayed for so long that there's a question about what the public will tolerate in terms of policy prescriptions if they're not convinced that this really is a major threat.
And then when we factor in that the U.S. House is Republican-controlled and that the president may have to spend a lot of political capital on his other key priorities like immigration reform and gun control and budget negotiations, factoring all that, what tools or what options are available to his administration to tackle climate change?
Really, they're all regulatory options. I don't think anyone envisions a significant legislative push on this issue. And so this means that President Obama will really use the powers that his executive branch already has embodied in the Clean Air Act, where, given that his Environmental Protection Agency has already declared carbon dioxide a pollutant, he can push for things including, for example, a limit on greenhouse gas emissions from existing power plants, which is something that hasn't been proposed. And also, interestingly, on the international stage, there are plenty of indications that both the president and John Kerry, as Secretary of State, will push for example, as meaningful an agreement as it can forge internationally, and particularly with climate, with China, the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions at this point.
So basically, just use existing laws, use government regulations to accomplish what he cannot accomplish legislatively.
Absolutely, because there's really no appetite in Congress for new regulations when it comes to climate change.
How quickly, though, do you think these new standards, especially for power plants, could be implemented? You know, because the EPA would oversee new regulations, but it basically has no leader. The EPA head, Lisa Jackson, has said she's stepping down soon, and the president has to get a new nominee approved. Is that really going to slow things down?
That's not going to have that much of an immediate impact in the sense that it certainly these new proposed power plant regulations, which people talk about as a possibility, couldn't be finalized for about a year anyway. So depending on how quickly one gets a new head of EPA, the staff can still work on them and you could still see action. But you raise a good point, which is, first of all, it's going to take a while for these regulations to be proposed. Then the rulemaking process takes at least another year. So we're talking talking about being 2 years off under the best case in terms of putting new carbon limits on power plants.
During the Obama administration's first term, it was unsuccessful in trying to get a cap and trade program through Congress. But lately, some Republicans have seemed willing to compromise on issues that they were intractable about before, like immigration and taxes. So does that mean that cap and trade or maybe any kind of carbon tax could be back on the table?
It seems very unlikely that that would be back on the table. I mean, certainly cap and trade, this idea of issuing pollution allowances to major emitters of greenhouse gases and allowing them to trade those, that's off the table. There's no one who's talking about that anymore, including the White House. In terms of a carbon tax, again, the White House has said repeatedly they're not going to propose this. There's the longest of long shots that it becomes raised as part of some broader fiscal discussion having to do with taxes. But even there, I would put the likelihood as minuscule that something like that would be enacted through Congress over the next few years.
In terms of the administration's climate change successes so far, carbon emissions have fallen about 8% since 2006. But that's partly because of the recession and cheap natural gas replacing coal as an energy source. But the administration during its first term did make what are considered some fairly large moves on energy and climate. In about the 30 seconds or so we have left, tick off for us some of those accomplishments in cutting carbon.
The biggest accomplishment would be stricter fuel efficiency standards for cars and light trucks. That's been responsible for a major cut in greenhouse gas emissions going forward. They're imposing a limit on greenhouse gas emissions from future power plants, and that will cut emissions as well.
We're talking with Washington Post environmental reporter Juliet Aylprin about climate change, President Obama's vocal new sense of urgency to do something about it, and just what he could do about it. We're about to take a short break, and we'll be coming back with a look at the controversial Keystone XL pipeline that would bring heavy crude oil from Canada to the U.S. for processing. Back in a minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Find over 200 job openings at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about climate change and how President Obama might deliver on his promise to continue reducing carbon emissions in his second term. We're talking with Washington Post environmental reporter Juliet Aylprin. And Juliet, the first big test the president is expected to face on this front is the Keystone XL project. This, of course, is the 1,700-mile pipeline that would bring 700,000 barrels of crude a day from Canada through the U.S. to processing plants on the Gulf of Mexico. Argument four is that it would bring thousands of jobs and millions of dollars to the U.S., help cut our reliance on foreign oil. Against is that this kind of refining process would take a heavy toll on the climate. Also concerns about spills and leaks along the pipeline. President Obama is expected to make his decision on Keystone this spring, and here he is at his first press conference after his reelection.
Understandably, I think the American people right now have been so focused and will continue to be focused on our economy and jobs and growth that, you know, if the message is somehow we're going to ignore jobs and growth simply to address climate change, I don't think anybody's going to go for that. I won't go for that.
Juliet, in that case, the president was answering a question about the feasibility of a carbon tax. But could that same thinking influence his decision on Keystone, the idea that jobs and growth have to come before tackling climate change?
Well, it certainly becomes harder for him, given that he's laid that out. And I've talked to White House officials, and they emphasize that, yes, he was talking in the context of a carbon tax, and he was talking in terms of fiscal negotiations he was having with Republicans. So you shouldn't extrapolate too much from it. But I think that this is a really pressing concern for him, that really, at this point, the strongest argument for vetoing this pipeline is its pure climate impact. And so that's a hard thing for him to stand up and explain to the American people.
Right. That's interesting. I mean, because there's the argument for jobs and so forth, but that's a shorter term benefit. And he's having to focus on longer term ills, really.
Right. I mean, it's looking over the long term. It's saying that, you know, we'll be able to both expand domestic production enough and also come up with alternative sources of energy, including renewable energy, that ultimately would, for example, make this 700,000 barrels a day of crude oil you know, less important for the U.S. So you certainly can make that argument, but it's a tougher argument to make than the immediate construction jobs that we're talking about, which are, you know, a few thousand a year, as well as simply that, you know, that supply to Gulf Coast refineries that want to process heavy crude oil.
Last week, Keystone took a step forward because the Republican governor of Nebraska, Dave Heineman, gave his blessing to the pipeline after it was rerouted to avoid crossing an environmentally sensitive part of the state. But the pipeline would still pass over a massive groundwater supply in Nebraska, the Ogallala Aquifer. How big a factor could that be in the president's decision?
I think it'll be a factor, but it's a lesser factor at this point. With the reroute, they have avoided some of the most sensitive areas. And so certainly while this was, for example, the reason he postponed a decision initially back last year, I think that, you know, that certainly would not be the ultimate reason one would veto this pipeline, even though it certainly can be a factor. And he could cite it when he makes his final decision.
The new U.S. Secretary of State, John Kerry, former Massachusetts senator, factors into this because the State Department has to give the okay to the project. Meanwhile, John Kerry has been a passionate advocate for tackling climate change. The State Department is nearing the end of its review of the project, and Kerry has said at his confirmation hearings last week that he would make, quote, the appropriate judgments about it. What do you think is going to be John Kerry's thought process here?
I think it's going to be one of the most tortured and important thought processes that certainly we'll be watching here in Washington. He has made climate a cause for his career more than almost any other single member of Congress. And so the idea that he would approve this pipeline would be an enormous blow to his standing in the environmental community. It's clearly going to be a major factor. He's already in private conversations indicated he's very well aware of the issues involved. And I do think it is important to note when you said, while the State Department is nearing the end of providing a draft of the environmental impact assessment, we still have some hoops to go through. They have to subject this to public comment. They need to look at what the national interest of the U.S. is. So it's still going to take some time. And you can imagine that there's no way that John Kerry won't be agonizing over what to do about this.
Any signals of which way he's leaning?
He has been very careful not to signal which way he is. But again, it's very interesting. He identified climate change as one of the top threats facing the United States globally. And so there's just no question he can't brush this aside. He needs to grapple with it. And he'd have to come up with a very powerful argument for why it should be approved, given the fact that he's really devoted his career to tackling global warming.
Environmental activists have done White House demonstrations before to protest Keystone. They have more actions planned for President's Day. This time, they're going to have another ally, the Sierra Club. This is one of the more conservative environmental groups, and for the first time in its 120-year history, it says its members can participate in peaceful civil disobedience in Keystone protests. In other words, get themselves arrested. The head of the Sierra Club said in a statement that, quote, for civil disobedience to be justified, something must be so wrong that it compels the strongest defensible protest. How big a deal is the Sierra Club move?
I mean, it signifies, I would just say, the passion among environmentalists on this issue. It's not, I mean, I'm sure there are plenty of people who privately, who are Sierra Club members, would have participated anyway. We've also seen that with the Natural Resources Defense Council. But I think what it does speak to is the fact that this is one of the two defining issues on climate that the administration will be facing. And it's really a legacy issue for the president himself, and certainly for how environmentalists and many Americans will view him. And so I think it gives you a sense of how serious this issue is. This is not a sideshow. This is a central question facing his legacy.
But even if environmental groups win and the Keystone Project doesn't end up running through the U.S., could this be a hollow victory in a way? Because wouldn't some other country like China be immediately willing to partner up with Canada and then would have those same emissions spewing in a different country?
That is the argument that the Canadians have made. I think what they're not saying is that logistically it's going to be several years before they would be able to ship out that oil. They've run into a number of problems in terms of another proposed pipeline, which would take the oil to British Columbia, so it could be shipped to Asia. First Nations, the Native Canadians, have considerable land rights, and it's unclear whether that path is going to be immediately available to them.
Juliet, based on your reporting, are you willing to say whether you think we're likely to eventually see Canadian crude running through American soil?
I think it's still a toss-up, but the fact that it's an open question shows that there are serious stakes.
Juliet Elprin covers the environment for The Washington Post, and she's the author of the book Demon Fish: Travels Through the Hidden World of Sharks. Juliet, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
News is next, here and now.